lot of good information, man. And if you can slowly get to understand that, people will meet a path to your door. You're one of those rare individuals that really understands wireless engineering, and it's a good thing to pursue, in my opinion, Bob. Back to you for a final comment on that, and then I'll be going back to Wes. N2MPJ, glad you asked. K2RAW and the Tech Man.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Bob first, and then I'll go over to Wes and Glenn in that order. Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, thank you, Dick. I'm going to do that. I'm going to pursue this because it's interesting. One of the key things that I might have missed, but you just mentioned, was this is E-field, which makes a lot of this make a lot more sense right now. Okay, I'll turn it over to you guys, and thank you very much. And to MPJ.
And Bob, I invite you to come back in future weeks and tell us what you've discovered and how you've been interpreted, because you're going down a path that can be very beneficial to you and others around you who will need the information you're going to derive. The number of people who have good understanding of this, the so-called electromagnetic compatibility engineers, they are pretty rare. And hopefully they're being treated very well because they're such rare animals and there's need for more of them. And the amount of misinformation and miscalculation, so to speak, on radio frequency biohazard is so huge. I mean, like the situation that's going on in Bayville, where essentially all the residents of that North Shore town on Long Island are trying to eliminate, take away, and blast out of existence every single antenna in that town. They're trying to remove all the antennas because they've come up to the erroneous conclusion that those antennas are giving the residents cancer. And they think they've seen evidence of the cancer happening, and therefore the antennas are causing it, and the antennas have to be eliminated. There's a lot of misunderstanding here. A lot of education is required. Now, Wes, you had a question on this one. N2XJN. Don't go into too many subjects now. Please try to keep it to one. N2XJN, K2RAW and the Tech Man.
Actually, it's hard to go. My response was pretty much covered later also. But what I could say, in addition to what you said, is when you were talking about the sun energy, you mentioned something like 1,000 watts per square meter, but then you said something that looks like it's 28 watts by the square meter, but we tried to find out the number of photons on the surface of the Earth. The 70% is back to the space, the 8% is scattered backwards by air molecules, 6% is directly reflected by the surface to the space. The total energy in nearby the vicinity of the Earth surface is 31%, and solar energy cell performance is 70%. That was only what I was trying to say. What is dangerous is not really how much energy comes into the body, but what is the bandwidth. So the ultraviolet out of sun radiation is the one that is responsible for any side effects. That side of the subject, so Glenn, pick up.
KC2QIQ, KQIW, go ahead, Glenn.
Good evening, Vic. I hope the other gentleman hasn't left already, but I believe that the measurement that he's discussing right now is part of the CE directive, the European compatibility measurements, and they have an IEC, radio frequency electromagnetic field immunity test. It's the 1000-4-3. Is this the testing that he's running? Because I probably have quite a bit of information for him on it, if he's still available. KC2QIQ.
Bob, N2MPJ, K2RAW, go right ahead.
Yes, that's what we're running. It's medical devices.
Give us a few more words on that one, Glenn.
Yeah, very good. This is very typical. Usually there's a CE mark, and also there's a part that's also part of Part 15. a lot of people aren't aware of that, but the two standards are very, very similar. And it's exactly as you said. You're basically taking an RF amplifier, a Yagi type of antenna that's set up in different polarizations. So usually there's a what they call an XYZ positioning of the item on the bench, and then there's two polarities, horizontal and vertical. So it's a total of six measurements. And typically what's happening here is there's directional coupler connected with the in series with the cable feeding the Yagi, and then they also have a feedback device that's measured on the table near the unit under test that will actually detect volts per meter. You following me so far, KC2QIQ?
I'm pretty sure we are, Rick Lance, so go ahead and proceed.
And basically what's happening here is that the device that they're using for the measurement is actually measuring volts per meter in free space. So in other words, from the amount of energy that's being fed from the antenna, because like you said, to do a direct calculation, there's so many rooms for error, and you have different polarizations to worry about. So what they're really interested in is to see, does this device get upset? In other words, if there's some functions, loose cables, improper grounding, ports that can be affected by this field of RF energy. And because they're interested in field strength in this particular area, and it's basically all E-field, and to see what gets disturbed. So that's it in its simplicity. But I wasn't sure if his question was going any deeper than that. KC2QIQ.
Maybe not right now, but I'm inviting Bob to come back in future weeks because this is a darn good subject, which is highly misunderstood by the general public and even quite misunderstood by good RF engineers. The number of RF engineers that I've met that understand the specifics of how to make electromagnetic compatibility measurements and susceptibility measurements conducted and radiated emission measurements. The number who can do it in a quantitative way traceable to the Bureau is a very small fraction. The way that we give instruction on this in our good schools, I know can be done better. So I'm inviting you to come back, Bob. Let us know what you discover as you dig deeper into the C95 report and the other reports that Glenn is referring to. On a quick break, Glenn, you've been involved in electromagnetic compatibility-like measurements, I'm guessing, for a good number of years. Is that true, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LAW.
Yeah, I think one of the first pieces of equipment that got hit with these European directives were was the power industry, switching power supplies. The kinds of measurements that we were always hit with were electromagnetic compatibility, the EMC, which means that, you know, you have to do conducted in radiated emissions. You have to do all the immunity tests, which were both, there again, conducted and radiated. So in other words, not only does the unit not have, it can't put out conducted noise on the line and can't conduct noise, radiate noise in the air, but it also has to be able to absorb. and then, of course, you have surge testing, or you have to basically do voltage transients, lightning strikes, ring waves, and all the other disturbances. Oh, I got a phone call back. KC2QIQ.
I can tell Glenn has been there and done that. Okay, there's a lot to this one. And maybe you're at the base of a fairly tall mountain here, Bob, but don't give up. It's worth pursuing. And John, we haven't heard a question from you for some time. KC2WGB. What would we like to discuss tonight, John? K2RIW and the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Quick question, Dick. What do they use, if you know, what do they use for proton detection? Are you aware of any instrument? That's my question. I've tried to research that, and I'm not doing too well.
As I've sometimes said, a smarter man knows what he doesn't know. Proton detection. First of all, the number of completely free protons in space on the average day is quite small in my environment. You have to be talking about some kind of a fairly violent reaction by which individual protons are emitted. Yeah, certain kinds of nuclear sources will do it. It's what little I know. So I guess a alpha particle is an alpha particle really a proton? Well, I guess the alpha particle is really, in many cases, a hydrogen nucleus or a helium nucleus. So it's probably a proton and neutron. So radiation detectors are in the right direction. But when you say you want a proton detector, let me dig a little bit deeper as to what your requirement is, John. Are you involved with some kind of a reaction where you know for a fact only protons are coming out, not protons plus neutrons, and not protons plus neutrons plus electrons? In other words, of the particles that are coming out of your reaction that you're studying, whatever it is, do you have reason to believe there's nothing but protons there, and you want to detect those completely free protons, or is it the protons that are mixed together with those other particles? So what are you trying to do, John? KC2WGB, KQRI WMTechNet.
Well, in a way, Dick, it's just a thought experiment that we know we have particles that are zooming around, and with violent crashes in the universe or nuclear reactions, explosions, things like that, there has to be protons. And I was just wondering if they're detectable and what they would use. I don't think scintillation would work, but I'm not sure. I just thought maybe you had read something about it, because I've read nothing about it.
Of all those cosmic rays, usually at very high velocities, that impinge on the Earth as a result of what's going on with a supernova explosion or something that's going on with neutron stars and white dwarfs and black holes and so on, lots of violent things are happening out there in the universe. So as you have the right kind of a detector, those cosmic rays are very detectable on the ground, even quite a few miles below ground. But as you start going into space, like where the International Space Station is located, you've got the Alpha Magnetic Detector, AMC, yeah, the Alpha Magnetic, all of a sudden I'm forgetting the name of this machine that I've been touting as such a great thing that was just added to the International Space Station. It's detecting a whole lot of positrons, positive polarity electrons that are existing in the cosmic rays, that you want to hit that, you want to do the detecting above the atmosphere before they get contaminated by hitting those atmospheric particles and turning into something else, if you know what I mean. So I think we're going to have to dig a little deeper on what is the alpha magnetic detector. Is that what it's called, AMD? When it's returned over a ball, he's going to correct me on this one. But let me pass it over to the net. Does anybody have anything to contribute as to if John wanted to have a relatively pure proton detector, where would he go? What would it be called? How much would it cost? What's its brand name? If you know anything about a proton detector, give us your call letters right now. KQRIW in the TechNet.
And to explain, the only word I got across, and I will send both of you the video of it, the CERN is using camera, sort of very much similar camera to the regular camera, but a little bit bigger, about 10 times the main diameter, main size diameter, and that's when they try to collide two protons. So at first I thought that CERN is concentrating on colliding the electrons, but that video shows how the protons could be isolated and then eventually speed up and drag to the collision. Also, there is a SLAC, S-L-A-C, accelerator, which is the first one to watch in order to understand then the proton acceleration. And they were able to achieve the proton acceleration up to 6 meters slower than the speed of light. And to explain.
Yeah, I think the SLAC is the Stanford Linear Accelerator. And CERN, that great big machine with 27 mile kilometer, the most powerful particle accelerator on planet Earth, over there in the Switzerland area, it also has a proton detector, and probably got four of them, anyhow, with various names. They've got these massive detecting chunks of hardware, which is as big as a house, which after you have that beam that's going clockwise and the beam that's going counterclockwise, and quite often they are protons, groups of protons, zillions of them in bundles. When they collide with each other in specific areas around that ring, the nearby detector tries to figure out the polarity, the direction of travel, the angle of deflection because of magnetic field, to figure out what is the polarity, magnitude, velocity, and so on, mass. These calorimeter-like cameras that are called, they certainly are a proton detector, and far from a portable device, looks to me like it weighs a zillion tons, costs a zillion dollars, and takes up the volume of a house or a little bit more. So is that a proton detector? Without a doubt. But I think John and I are wishing that somebody had a portable handheld device that would do it. A scintillation detector, somehow I doubt it. I think there's more involved here. So I think we've got to dig a little bit deeper, John. And at this time, I think it's time we go over to the mailbag, John. And these great guys that send you these letters, where they're trying to find out how everything works, what kind of great letters you've received this week so far, John. KC2 WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, want to welcome everybody to the TechNet. It's a pleasure to have everybody stop by. Good night tonight. All right. Yes, I have an antenna question from a ham. Yeah, okay, he's a ham operator. Dick, what he has is he has 5 2-meter transmitter receivers, and he has an antenna for each one. One is a Yagi, 3 are verticals, and the other one is a horizontal dipole. His question is, he doesn't use them all at once, he's using one at a time, but he's worried about his pattern of radiation because they all resonated 2 meters. Is he better off terminating the antennas on the ones not used, open them, or ground them? What should he do to prevent them from interfering with his transmission when he's using other antennas? That's basically his question, Dick. Over to you, KC2WGB.
And I'm pretty sure as we're all about to find out, there's no simple answer to this one. If my individual antennas have a significant number of wavelengths of separation, and you're about to ask how much is significant, I'm guessing 1, 2, 3 wavelengths of separation most of the time, will be such that the antennas will be thoroughly independent, and therefore the unused antennas, whether you terminate them with a short circuit, open circuit, or a 50 ohm resistor, almost doesn't matter. There's a couple of exceptions to that, and that is if the adjacent antenna happens to be a 28-foot diameter dish, then one wavelength of separation is not going to stop you from getting interference from it. And if your antenna on the test is sitting in front of a 28-foot diameter parabolic dish antenna, and you're in front of it 10 feet away, and you're making measurements, and you want to measure a specific E-field or signal strength or whatever, guarantee a hell of a lot of energy that missed your antenna on the first pass, hits the parabolic dish, gets focused, comes back, and hits your antenna a second time. And is that going to be giving you interference? Yay, verily. And with that power, a 28-foot dish antenna, whether you terminate its feed horn with a short circuit, open circuit, or 50-ohm resistor, ain't going to matter very much. It's going to give you a hell of a lot of interference. So, as you can tell, you have to look at what you believe or can calculate is the effective capture area. Let me drop. Calculating the effective capture area under normal circumstances of your particular antenna, it's the beginning of the situation. But if you're trying to make a very pure measurement of E field and power flux density, milliwatts per square centimeters or whatever, in the ideal world, you'd like to have nothing but the single sensing antenna in that environment, and to some degree, every other piece of metal in the environment, every other piece of dielectric material in the environment, just because the thing in the environment happens to be something called an insulator, a by 4 log is sitting 3 feet away. You think, hey, it's an insulator, you can ignore it. I've been down that road with the engineers that were working at the Benfield Anechoic Facility at Edwards Air Force Base. That a whole bunch of wooden structures in this $63 million anechoic chamber. They had built a bunch of wooden structures held together with wooden pegs and glue, and they wanted to dream that these wooden structures were not going to be creating any interference to the measurements. And they were creating a hell of a lot of interference, because at 10 gigahertz, for instance, the reflection from a 4x4 is only a couple of dB weaker than a chunk of steel of the same size. And the net result is that they had to cover everything with absorptive materials to stop them from reflecting. That tree in your backyard is a reflecting device at microwave frequencies. So everything, whether it be a thing you call antenna, or whether it be a thing you call 2x4, or a thing you call tree, or a thing you call a piece of metal, they're all going to be, to some degree, interfering with specific measurements. And the amount of interference, let me drop. The amount of interference, if you're smart enough, is calculatable and is measurable. You can do a before and after test. In other words, you can make the measurement in a pure environment and then add these unknown devices. And for that particular frequency and that particular angle of arrival and that particular location of these other things, 2x4, chunk of steel, or an antenna, you can find out how much it's changing. So for reasonable kinds of Yagi-like antennas that we use, there are times when the interference is extremely small. Like, for instance, if I mounted my 2-meter Yagi 3 feet above a 6-meter Yagi, the presence of the 6-meter Yagi almost doesn't matter. Very, very little interference. That 6-meter Yagi is reasonably transparent at 2 meters. The 2-meter Yagi is very, very transparent at 6 meters. So once you understand the amount of lack of coupling between the two, it allows you to stack antennas along your vertical mast coming out of the top of your tower at a hell of a lot closer angles, closer spacings than you think. I'll give you one more point on this one. Good common sense leads you to believe that if I'm stacking a pair of 2-meter Yagis, and if I do a calculation that each Yagi represents an effective capture area that's a 10-foot diameter circle of space, then that pair of 2-meter Yagis, if I want full performance out of them, should be stacked something close to 10 feet apart. Okay, now I'm stacking a 432 Yagi above a 2-meter Yagi. My 432 Yagi may represent a 5.7-foot diameter circle. That's exactly what you get out of a RIW-19 Yagi. And the 2-meter Yagi might be a 10-foot diameter circle. So 10 plus 5.7, you'd think you have to space them 15.7 feet apart. Absolutely not. When you're on 2 meters, that 432 Yagi is not there. When you're on 432, the 2-meter Yagi is not there. And you can probably space them 2 feet apart, not 15.7 feet apart. Done that, made measurements before and after, and the amount of disturbance of the field is extremely small. So when the antennas are on the same frequency, they've got a bigger characteristic interference than if they're on different frequencies. So I know your writer is not getting a direct answer to this question, John, but at least you're knowing more of the ingredients involved. And it's not quite as simple as first when written, if you know what I mean. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2QIQ.
Go ahead, Glenn. Give us your words on this one.
I'm completely in agreement on what you're saying, Dick. It's awesome. The only thing I was going to wonder, it was just an opinion of yours, is that, in other words, experiences that I've had with stacked Yagis and going with a single Yagi was that it just seems to me, my impression, but I wanted some of your feedback on this. If I had a single Yagi at 100 feet, I think I see better performance than two Yagis at 40 feet, if you know what I'm saying with this one. Maybe you have a couple of words on that one. It just seems to me that, certainly if you probably had the stacked set all the way up at 100, it'd be great, but I'm just saying if I had the choice between one Yagi at 100 feet or two Yagis at 40, I'd probably go with the one at 100, but I'm just kind of interested in what kind of words you might have on this one. KC2QIQ.
Good question.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you what I observed on this one. If you Google the word K2RIW and do enough searching, you'll eventually find the red QSL card. And on the front end of that red QSL card that says K2RIW, you'll see a picture. And that picture is me standing in the middle of my array of 16 Yagis on 432 on the top of a 100-foot tower. So that's a 3,500-cubic-foot antenna, 16 Yagis, 19 elements each, 304 elements total, 29 dB of gain. That's the antenna I used for talking for 4.5 years to K4CAW, 480 miles away, single sideband, every Tuesday night for 4.5 years, for a half hour. Anyhow, what I also did was at the 70-foot level, put a single Yagi on a yardarm, on a sidearm with its own rotator, and that 16 Yagi array that's in that picture on top of the tower had a bunch of relays inside that I called the zoom control, where I could look at all 16 Yagis, one vertical string of 4 Yagis, or one single Yagi at the top. One of the most interesting experiments, let me drop, was on a number of occasions within band openings or non-band openings, where the guy is 10 miles away or 200 miles away, I would listen to a signal with one Yagi at the 70-foot level versus one Yagi at the 105-foot level. And what did I see? Most of the time, the antenna at the higher level gave a signal 10 decibels stronger than the antenna at the lower level. My trees are roughly 65 feet high in that area, 70 feet high. And so the antenna at the 70-foot level was near the tops of the trees. When I stood at that level of the tower, I got a very good view of the horizon in most directions. So in the directions where I get a good view of the horizon, I compare the signal strength at 70 feet versus 105, and there's 10 dB of difference. Most of the time, one or two particular nights, for about a 1 hour period of time, with some kind of a weird propagation condition, the signal at the 70-foot level and the signal at the 105-foot level were essentially identical in amplitude. So most of the time, altitude always helps. K1WHS, Dave O'Lean of Directive Systems in Lebanon, Maine, he's got a 2,000-foot mountain in his backyard, which he owns, and at the top of that mountain contains some very significant antennas that he uses for his contest operations. Let me drop. And also in the backyard, at the base of the mountain, he's got a bunch of antennas. His moon bounce array is there. And when he compares signal strength versus altitude on the mountain, no contest, on top of his mountain, he's got something like 150 feet high Rhone 55 tower. And when he starts comparing the signal strength at the top of the tower, the middle of the tower, and the bottom of the tower, when the tower is sitting on top of a 2,000-foot mountain, you would think that, hey, everything would wash out in that case. Altitude on VHF signals over the horizon, there was always an advantage of altitude. So as you guys have heard me say so often, there are three things that make a VHF antenna work well. Location, 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 or altitude, altitude, altitude. If on a 2-meter band, for instance, you're going to take a $1,000 whiz-bang antenna, gold-plated with all kinds of high performance, traceable to the bureau, and you're going to mount it in your backyard, and you're going to compare it to a coat hanger wire yucky antenna mounted at the top of the tower, no contest. That yucky antenna at the top of the tower is going to sing a hell of a lot louder than the thing and than the very expensive antenna down low. So altitude counts a lot on VHF 98% of the time. Once in a while, crazy weather conditions reverse the situation a little bit, but that's rare. So if you want to be a serious VHF operator, you're going to build some altitude into your system, Glenn. And so how soon are you going to be putting that tower into Massapequa? KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Unfortunately, Dick, I can't do it at this location, but maybe the next one, it'll definitely be there. But you're exactly saying what I've noticed in everything all along, altitude. And oddly enough, I think it follows suit even on the other bands. In other words, even on 80 meters, my goodness, if you had the real estate and the hardware and the structure, so to speak, if even on your, even your 80 meter antenna at altitude is going to do so much better than it will on the ground. Back to you, Dick. KC2QIQ. Always a pleasure.
And now, John, I want to hear from you. I know that in the work that you do, a group of people came to your backyard one day with an antenna on the trailer, and they erected the antenna, and it's a telescoping tower-like structure, and they raised that antenna and your property some significant number of feet, and then you started measuring signal strength up high versus down low. I know you found a hell of a lot of signal up high. I know that soon after that measurement was made, you had, at least for that period of time, a hell of a lot of enthusiasm about saying that, yeah, maybe it's time you put up a tower. And you talk to anybody like me or you who, you know, hesitated for a long period of time because of cost and risk and visibility and whatever, and eventually put up a tower. With rare exception, they say, why in the world did I wait so long? Look how much fun I'm now having. So you were about to put a tower into your backyard, and I think you ought to consider reinstating that operation, John, and give us a couple of words as to what that measurement was like when that antenna was raised and you started seeing a hell of a lot more signal, and you live on a good-sized hill there in Staten Island. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh yeah, Dick, it was quite impressive, and it went up about 40 feet, that elevated tower. It was a crank-up that was on a vehicle. The reason it came here was to show me why a Doppler wouldn't work for me in what I was looking to do. And they showed me the difference when it was raised to an elevation of 40 foot above my property, how well the Doppler worked. But when it was lowered to where my Doppler would be mounted, the reflections from the surrounding hills made it almost useless. It was jumping all over the place. So the other thing was, when it was up, there were a few antennas up there coupled into them. And the difference between the signals I was receiving on the upper antennas compared to the ones that were down on the ground was quite significant. The ones on the ground worked well on receiving, but I can imagine the difference it would be. I didn't get a chance to transmit with them, but the reception was detectable, the difference. So I can imagine the reception, the transmission, would have been much more.
Let me add a couple of words to this one, John. There was a National Bureau of Standards publication around 1970 that I remember, and I got a copy of it, which says, when it comes to over-the-horizon tropo-like VHF, UHF signals, the answer is 6 dB per degree, or is it 12 dB? 12 dB per degree. Whenever you change the altitude or location or sighting characteristic of an antenna that's looking at a signal coming from over the horizon, a long distance away. I mean, at the top of my tower, I've got, in theory, a radio horizon that's out there, an optical horizon 40 miles away. So if I'm listening to signals that are more than 40 miles away, 12 dB per degree. In other words, as I raise the antenna, look at a different direction or whatever, so that the horizon, from my point of view, dips away by one more degree, all the signals over that horizon will be 12 decibels stronger. And what is 1 degree? 92 feet per mile. If there happens to be a hill 1 mile away from me, what that calculation is saying from the National Bureau of Standards of roughly 1970, if that hill is 1 mile away from me, every time I raise my antenna 92 feet, 1 degree is 92 feet per mile. Every time I raise my antenna 92 feet, that hill now looks like it's 1 degree lower to my line of sight. All signals coming over that hill will get 12 decibels stronger. That gives you a rough rule of thumb. It's not exact, but it gives you a ballpark figure, rule of thumb, to tell you what you're going to buy when you add extra altitude. That's if you've got a completely smooth horizon with one hill in front of you. The rest of us really have trees, water towers, buildings, other houses, whatever. All kinds of stuff is in our environment. You start putting repeater. Time out. We have all kinds of stuff in our environment.
you put up a tower where you start clearing that stuff, particularly the trees, oh boy, you're going to see improvements. Back in the days when I had calibrated my receiver in microvolts, and everybody on 432 in the Long Island area used to get a great kick out of saying, hey, Dick, I just changed from this antenna to that antenna. I moved the antenna 10 more feet higher on the mast. I changed the tower. It's a crank-up tower, and the wind's not blowing, so I'm cranking it up a little bit higher tonight. How many microvolts am I giving you tonight? And so my calibrated receiver, I would tell it how many microvolts they're getting, and we can convert it into decibels or any other, or signal strength units. And so they had a quantitative way of finding out. And what we rapidly discovered is that when a guy did anything to make his antennas clear the trees, on 432, for instance, he started getting stronger real fast. When his antenna was below the trees in the summertime and there's leaves on the trees, particularly after a rain, when the leaves are wet and he's transmitting through them, my goodness, is that an absorber. As the leaves dried out, the signal got stronger. As winter came and the leaves dropped off the trees, the signal got stronger. As he raised his antenna in any of those environments, the signal got stronger. So what makes a good VHF signal stronger? What allows you to talk greater range? How did I talk 480 miles, day in and day out, summer, winter, spring, and fall, talking to K4CAW on 432 sideband? It's because I'm using 100 feet of tower, sitting on 300 foot, almost 290 foot above sea level land, clearing the trees, good clean horizon in that direction, a strong amount of signal gain by way of a 29 dB gain antenna, 16 Yagis, 700 watts being fed into it of sideband from a parallel kilowatt amplifier, and that thing can kick tail, if you know what I mean. KC2,
repeater, timeout.
So it's a matter of having enough ERP when you transmit, enough gain, enough altitude, and a strong enough transmitter, enough affected area on receiving, and a low enough noise figure in the receiver. And by the way, those 480 miles. I was very disappointed 4 years later when Hurricane Gloria removed the antenna from the tower. And while it was sitting on the ground, I took it all apart and made measurements, and I found out the FM8 cable, which I thought was a Cadillac cable in those days. This was a foam-filled coaxial cable with a polyethylene outer jacket. It was slowly absorbing water. And as such, the foam with the water, every one of those phasing harnesses developed a couple of more decibels of insertion loss within the phasing harness of the power dividers of that antenna. So by way of the loss of the cable, my system had two or three decibels higher noise figure. And if I could have lowered that noise figure by recognizing that detriment, had I known to correct that antenna, my goodness, if I was talking 480 miles before, it would have been time to start scheduling guys at Florida at 1,200 miles and find out how often the 432 sideband signal would get through from that distance. I have nightmares knowing about what I didn't see because of that error that I didn't know about. KC2, WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2, WGB. Well, Dick, you got the numbers just about right, because what I noticed was, now, of course, the hill that I'm talking about is to my west. Signals were coming from the west. But the hill is not even. It has some undulating caps and things where, so you get a little lower and higher. I don't know exactly the direction it was coming from, but when they elevated it 40, 45 feet, the S units went up from 1.5 S units to 2 S units. Now, exactly the height where it was, I don't know, but that was the gain difference on the same station according of relative to my ground station antenna. Fantastic improvement.
Hey, John, you've got the resources. You've got a good working relationship with your neighbors. You're in one of the 5 boroughs of New York City, which is very friendly to ham radio operators and towers. How soon are you going to be putting that tower in your backyard, John? And even if you're afraid to climb it, you have the resources to hire the monkey that can climb it for you, or you can decide to put up a crank-up tower where you can crank it down and tilt it over to do the adjustments and then crank it back up. How soon is that tower going to go into your backyard, John? KC2WGB, K2RW, and go on with the next one if you want to.
Been rather busy at the house here making some redesign of my sewer, and I had laborers and plumbers here over the weekend, so that ate up a little bit of the money that was supposed to go for the tower, because I apportioned each project with the funding also, and I had to take the funding from there. But I am definitely going to do it. I will put up a tilt down so that it's easier for me to work, but I'm going to get a crank-up tilt down. So there, you know, if it's down at 11, 12 feet, something like that, that's convenient to work on, no problem at all. And I'll be able to put a lot of stuff up there. And, oh, by the way, the fellow with the 5-inch transmitters and antennas, he did notice something. That's what brought this about. He had his field strength meter hooked up to one of the vertical 2 meters. Let me let it drop. And as he was rotating his Yagi and transmitting, he noticed the effect of the side lobes as he rotated the antenna and how much power he was receiving on the antenna with the RF field strength meter. That's what brought this up. He realized it was absorbing energy and had to be making trouble with his radiation pattern. That's why he came up with this question, just to inform you on that.
Now, be a little bit careful on that one. Every antenna of any reasonable performance, Yagi-like structure, by definition, is going to have side lobes. And when the Yagi is tuned for the best possible performance, it is my opinion the first side lobe should be 17.5 dB down, second side lobe should be 21 dB down, or 22 dB down, as I remember. When the antenna is peaked for gain, forward gain at the foresight, it will have those side lobes. And don't fall into the trap of thinking that just because you make the side lobes get weaker and weaker, that the antenna is becoming more and more efficient of the main lobe. That's not the way it works. But when it comes to the side lobes of an antenna, they are a lot more susceptible to adjacent objects. You make a side lobe measurement of an antenna with or without some other object in the vicinity. The side lobes will change very rapidly by comparison to the main lobe. And you'll come to the false impression that, hey, it's making a big impact on the gain. Not necessarily. And those side lobes, good common sense would lead you to believe the side lobes, let me drop them. Good common sense would lead you to believe that the side lobes represent wasted energy when you're transmitting. Absolutely not. By the laws of diffraction, the way Mother Nature works with phased array-like structures, or an antenna that has any finite amount of aperture to it with a certain aperture distribution, for a whole bunch of good mathematical, physics, and whatever reasons, high-performance antennas will have side lobes. In many cases, of predictable magnitude. Those side lobes do not represent wasted energy. Don't go down that road, even though it's good common sense. Learn to love them, if you know what I mean. They tell you the antenna is giving you high performance. By the same token, your carefully tuned Newtonian or Schmidt-Cassegrain telescope, which is at the highest performance it'll ever give, which is called diffraction-limited performance, it has a predictable airy disk. Those are the fancy optical words they use, which means side lobes. And when the parabolic mirror of your Newtonian telescope is giving the best performance, and you measure the exact magnitude of each of those outer rings of the airy disk, in other words, you take a photograph of a star, and you use the highest gain the scope has got, and you expand the photograph as much as you get, and you'll realize that that star on your photograph has got a bright dot in the center, and it's got a bunch of dim rings around it. Those rings are the side lobes of the telescope. And when you look at Suter's book on how to tune a telescope for best performance, you'll find out that that first ring, the first side lobe, is 17.5 dB down. The second side lobe is 22 dB down. And you say, hey, I've seen those numbers before. A well-tuned Yagi does that.
Repeater, timeout.
A well-tuned Yagi does that. We've been looking at that airy disk for years. When we look at a well-tuned Yagi, we just didn't recognize it. By the laws of physics, it's got to be there. So don't lose a whole lot. lot of sleep about the side lobes going up and down in amplitude because you've got adjacent antennas. And yes, because of their crazy kind of sensitivity, as you take those unused antennas that are nearby and terminate them with a short circuit, open circuit, 50 ohm resistor, capacitor, inductor, or whatever, you will see in some cases changes in the amplitude of that side lobe. It doesn't necessarily represent bad news. You got to be careful how you interpret it. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Well, I have a question, Dick. On the Aggie, when it's in its motion, being rotated, and you have your RF field strength meter at a specific distance, you know, maybe 50 feet away, you'll notice the duration on the main lobe is much longer. On the side lobes, it's much quicker. That's because that beam is much more narrow, right?
You're now getting into the science of what's called aperture distribution. In other words, every antenna you and I build, use, or whatever, or buy, has a real effective capture area to it. Your eye may not see it, but that radio wave does. It's there. And with in most cases, like that diffraction-limited telescope or your high-performance antenna, Yagi maybe, Dish maybe, you get the highest possible gain of the main lobe when you have a uniform distribution. In other words, to make a simple example, I've got this great big parabolic dish antenna that I'm using on UHF frequencies, and if I had the ability to buy a feed horn, which when I'm transmitting, it would smear my RF energy equally across the parabolic dish, so that the watts per square meter in the center of the dish at the apex and the watts per square meter at the perimeter, if I could make them equal, uniform distribution, I get the highest possible gain out of the dish. Okay, that uniform distribution, when you now start using the Fourier transform to calculate what should the antenna pattern be, for a bunch of complicated reasons, you'll find that the number of degrees of width of the main lobe is roughly twice as many degrees as each one of the side lobes. There's a bunch of complicated mathematics as to why it has to be that way, but it's got to be that way. And I'm going to try to think of a simpler way of explaining it. But when you see that, it is not telling you something is wrong. It's telling you something is right. The main lobe has got to be twice as wide in degrees as those side lobes when the antenna is properly tuned for best performance. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, then if you had a 70-degree beam width on the main lobe, you would consider 35 degrees to be normal on the first side lobe? Would that be correct?
Yes, John, that is the right ballpark. Now you've got to be a little bit careful. When it comes to the beam width of the main lobe, we can talk about the 3 dB beam width, the 10 dB beam width, or the null beam width. And the side lobes, we usually talk about the null beam width of the side lobe. So as long as you're using an apple and an apple comparison, 3 dB, 3 dB, or null to null, yes, it's almost always a 2-to-1 ratio, is my memory, but I'm going to double check. I know the main lobe is always a hell of a lot wider, so to speak, than the side lobes, and I believe for most of the kinds of antennas we use, it's a 2-to-1 ratio. You've got to be a little bit careful now. Is the aperture a square aperture or a round aperture? And there may be a little bit of difference of this ratio, but it's in that ballpark in both cases, roughly 2-to-1 when you're comparing the apple to the apple. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, then that would follow that as it's rotating at an equal speed, if you had a 2-second reading for the main lobe, 1 second for the first lobe, side lobe, would be considered close to normal.
Well, you've got to be a little bit careful here. When you say reading, when you sweep an antenna and you're listening to what's coming out of the loudspeaker, so to speak, or out of the earphones, you're talking about the period of time the signal is giving you a desirable signal-to-noise ratio. That main lobe is 17.5 dB stronger at its peak than the side lobe at its peak. So when it comes to threshold measurements, you you're going to find the side lobe considerably more narrow than that, because you got to go a good number of degrees off of that main lobe, because it's 17 dB stronger. You have to go a good number of degrees off of one side before the main lobe fades. Whereas the side lobe, the peak of it starts off 17.5 dB down, and now you're measuring threshold to threshold on the side lobe. In that environment, I think you're going to find the side lobe appears to be 3 or 4 times more narrow than the main lobe because of the threshold characteristic. But if you're running your strip chart recorder looking at signal strength, and you properly interpret what you're looking at, it will be a 2-to-1 ratio. Over to you, John, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick, then what he observed seems to fit. Very good. Okay, if you had time, I got one more quick question for you from another young ham.
Now, these are fun. Go for it, John.
Okay, the never-go-away TV questions. This young ham has listened to the program on DBs on the amateur radio.tv, with Mel and you discussing DBs. But he still doesn't understand 0 dBm. Why should there be a signal if it's 0 dBm? Maybe you could just give him a quick explanation on that. He's really trying hard on this. And then we'll go over to Paul after that. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
I had a client in my consulting business who is buying antennas to be applied to a particular problem, and he's looking at the data sheets of all the antennas he can buy, and one of the antennas is kind of expensive and it claims 2.2 dB of gain. Another antenna, a little bit less expensive, is 1.5 dB of gain, and one of the antennas said it had 0 dB over isotropic, and he was trying to calculate a bang for the dollar, decibels per dollar, so to speak. And when he looked at the 0 dB antenna, he's dividing by 0 and coming up with answers that are crazy. The whole decibel scale is not absolute, so to speak. Okay, you'll be careful how you use those words. Let me drop. If I'm talking about the amount of power coming out of transmitter, and I talk about this transmitter gives me 100 watts, that one gives me 1,000 watts, this QRP transmitter gives me 5 watts, this little transistorized QRP thing gives me 100 milliwatts, those are absolute power measurements. And zero in power means nothing, zero. Okay, the whole decibel chunk of mathematics is a ratio. Okay, a decibel really is one power level compared to another power level as a ratio. And when it comes to antennas, we always use something as a standard, the isotropic antenna. It's kind of a theoretical antenna. A light bulb in the middle of a spherical room is an isotropic antenna, an old-fashioned incandescent light bulb. In other words, it's radiating light in all directions, and in that spherical room, every square foot of that room is getting the same amount of illumination. That's an isotropic antenna. Mathematically speaking, let me drop. Mathematically speaking, if my antenna has 1 watt of power going into it, and if it was a theoretical isotropic antenna, I know how much power is putting into every square degree, so to speak. If it was in the middle of a spherical object, I know how much power is going to go across each square inch or square centimeter of that sphere, because it's isotropic and it's obeying conservation of energy. That's the reference. Now the antenna that I'm about to measure is either stronger or weaker than that. Hopefully every antenna is stronger than 0 dB isotropic. An isotropic antenna is the lowest gain antenna in the world that has no loss. Every other real antenna is taking some of that energy and focusing it like a flashlight in some direction. It's putting more energy in some direction and less in some other. You take the peak direction, peak energy direction, compare it to isotropic, and convert it to decibels, which is a ratio. So 0 dB of ratio is a 1-to-1 relationship. If my antenna had 0 dB of gain, 0 dBi, 0 dB with reference to isotropic, that means it's equal to isotropic. If it was minus 3 dBi, that means it's 3 dB lower than isotropic, which theoretically can't be done unless it has loss. So you give me an isotropic antenna, as in an antenna under test, and somebody didn't tell you that there's a 3 dB attenuator in that transmission line going into that antenna, so it's got 3 dB of real loss. Yes, that antenna can be minus 3 dBi, 3 dB over isotropic. An antenna with truly 0 dB of gain, zero gain. You'd now be comparing that antenna to something that's a real called isotropic. It would be minus infinity dB.
Repeater, timeout.
So the absolute absence of all signal is minus a very large number of decibels. 0 dBm happens to be 1 milliwatt. There, in the dBm scale, the reference is 1 milliwatt. dBm, the M stands for milliwatt, decibels with reference to milliwatt. And you can also use units of dBw, decibels with reference to 1 watt. And dB microvolt, there's a dB microvolt scale that's used in electromagnetic compatibility measurements. So all decibels are a ratio, a comparison to something. And you only get the lack of all signal. The zero signal case is minus infinity in decibels. The first time you hear this, I know it's a little bit crazy. And the mathematics of decibels, the good news is that a modern-day inexpensive handheld calculator, you put in your numbers, the number on top and the number on the bottom, because there's always a ratio for decibels. Something is 4 to 1 better, that's going to be 6 decibels, if you know what I mean. You put in that the ratio as a hard number, then you press the decibel scale, or the logarithmic scale, and multiply by 10, because it's decibel as opposed to bell. You could measure the gain in bells if you want to. Microbells, bells, mini bells, or kilobells. It sounds crazy, but although it's unpopular, those are real units. So you take the log of your ratio, multiply by 10, you've now got units of decibel. And it takes a while to get used to them. I'll admit it's not straightforward. However, when you're stringing a bunch of amplifiers together, and you got lossy cables in between them, and you got an antenna, and you're trying to evaluate a system, and you figure out the amount of gain of each amplifier, the amount of loss of each cable in between, and the gain of the antenna, you can now add and subtract very simple arithmetic numbers when you're working in decibels. If you're working in hard numbers, a 30 dB gain amplifier has got a 1,000 to 1 power ratio of what goes in and comes out. Well, what happens if it's a power ratio of 3,174 for the first amplifier and 261.5 for the second amplifier and so on? You try to multiply those power ratios in hard numbers when you're stringing things together. With a handheld calculator, it's easy. Back in the days when you had to do it with pencil and paper, it'll drive you up a wall. But you convert every one of those gain numbers of each of those amplifiers to decibels, and now you're adding some very simple numbers. Adding simple numbers is a hell of a lot easier than multiplying these great big complicated numbers to do it the old way, if you know what I mean. So it's a good thing to learn, even though at first it's not easy. I recommend you make the investment. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. The real engineers, live in the decibel world. You got it, John.
J2B with a question.
JTB, go right ahead. J2B.
Hey, Dick, I just have a question about the isotropic radiator. Isn't that relation to polarization of the antenna also? You're going to say a vertical dipole is reference to isotropic. Isn't polarity important? Like if you have an isotropic vertical antenna and then you talk about a circular antenna, like it's minus 3 dB on the circular antenna from isotropic, isn't polarity come into play also? I was just curious. WJTV.
Every antenna, Joe, has a lot to do with polarity. In other words, if I've got a horizontally polarized Yagi, and in my case, my Yagi is rotated in polarization. The Yagi you're listening to right now is rotated in polarization at a 45-degree angle. I'm halfway between horizontal and vertical. That means that Yagi gives me the ability to talk to the horizontal sideband people and the ability to talk to the vertically polarized FM repeater people.